Well, if you have a Bible, you might want to turn with me to Paul's letter to the Romans and chapter 8. And I'd like us this morning to focus then on one particular verse here in the 8th chapter of Romans. It's verse 32. Romans 8, verse 32, where Paul writes, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" So this verse doesn't belong to the New Testament passion narratives. It doesn't even belong to the New Testament Gospels. But it is nonetheless an appropriate verse for Good Friday morning. At the heart of it is a particular verb, the verb to give up. Now, in our terminology, to give up means, or can mean, perhaps most often means, to pack in. I'm sure there were some runners in last weekend's London Marathon who gave up, who failed to complete the race. But that's not the kind of giving up we're talking about here. Perhaps the language of handing over might make it clearer. We're talking here about God handing over Jesus. Jesus here being handed over. Handed over to what? Well, handed over, of course, to suffering and death on Calvary's cross. And so, as I say, despite its location in the Bible, this is, I think, prime material for Good Friday morning. Jesus being handed over to suffering and death at Calvary. And so, in that connection then, just for a few minutes, I would like us to notice three things here. First of all, the truth of the cross. The truth of the cross. So the story is starting to recede now from the media spotlight, but for quite some time, people all over the world have been asking the question, what happened to Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. We seem to know now that it crashed, and indeed that it crashed into the southern Indian Ocean. But is there more to it than that? Is there something else involved in the story? Was there hijacking involved? Was there terrorism involved? Was there suicide involved? To be sure, no aeroplane technology is invincible. No aeroplane pilot is infallible. Planes do sometimes crash. But in this case, is the story more complex? What is the truth, people have been asking, of that disaster? And we might ask similar questions regarding the events of Good Friday. We know that Jesus on that day was crucified along with two others outside the city of Jerusalem. But is there more to it than that? To be sure, in the Roman world of the first century, people got crucified. This certainly wasn't an unheard of event. But in this case, is the story more complex? What is the truth, we need to ask, of the cross? Well, in this verse, Paul tells us the truth of the cross. In particular, he highlights three surprising elements. Three elements that aren't necessarily apparent on the surface of the events. Three elements which I bet most of your colleagues, though aware of Good Friday and glad for the day off work that it gives them, would know nothing about. Three elements that, once grasped, place the whole thing in a completely new light. So, element number one, the person responsible. The person responsible. Mind-blowingly, Paul says, it was God. God gave up Jesus. God handed Jesus over. And Paul isn't being clever here. He isn't being philosophical here. He isn't saying that because God is sovereign over the universe, because God has predestined every twist and turn of history, because God is the one from whom and through whom and to whom are all things, then it follows logically that if you go back far enough, you can trace a convoluted path from the events of Good Friday to the decrees and overruling providence of God. He's not being clever like that. Paul is being perfectly straightforward here. His grammar is straightforward. The verb is gave up, and the subject of the verb is he, i.e. God. God gave Jesus up. His grammar is straightforward, and his meaning, therefore, is straightforward. He's saying God did it. God did it. Doesn't mean that there weren't particular means and mechanisms that God used. You can read all about those in the Passion narratives. Treacherous kisses and baying crowds and callous soldiers. All of those played their parts. But the point is clear. God did it. It was his thing. He's the person responsible. Surprising element number two. The content involved. The content involved. Notice that what God did to Jesus that day is actually described in two ways, isn't it, in our text? Yes, it's described as a giving up or a handing over, but it's also described as a not sparing. God didn't spare Jesus. Now that language is interesting, this verb spare is used in the Greek New Testament on 9 other occasions. On 5 of those occasions, the context is a horizontal one. It's a human being sparing or not sparing other human beings. On the 4 other occasions, however, the context is a vertical one. It's God not sparing his creatures. And in each of those cases, he doesn't spare them in the most final and absolute sense. You see, we might speak like this, mightn't we? We might say that after a dismal 45 minutes, the Manchester United coach didn't spare his players during the half-time interval. Now, all that we mean by that is that he gave them a good talking to at half-time. He gave them a piece of his mind. He read the riot act to them. We don't mean that he picked up a chainsaw and amputated the legs of the worst performing players. We don't mean that he doused them with petrol and then set fire to them all. We don't mean that he got a machine gun and fired indiscriminately until the walls of the changing room were red with the blood of his players. He did spare them those things. He did spare the many indignities and cruelties that he could have subjected them to, but when we say that he didn't spare them, we're using a figure of speech, aren't we? We're exaggerating when we say that. But when the Bible says that God did not spare ... it means it literally. It means that the omnipotent Lord did his worst to them. It means that God unleashed his fiercest, harshest, most bitter vengeance on them. That's what it means when the New Testament talks about God not sparing. So Romans 11, verse 21. That verse actually accounts for 2 of the 4 occurrences. And Paul's talking there about God's treatment of those first century Jews who, despite all their privileges, despite having the Messiah come and live in their midst, yet disowned their Messiah. And Paul says, as a consequence, God did not spare them. And what that means is elaborated in an earlier verse, in verse 15 of that same chapter, where Paul refers to their rejection. That is the Jews' rejection by God. God has rejected them. And that word rejection, it literally means throwing away, tossing away. It's what you do with garbage. So in Romans 11:21, to be not spared by God is to be thrown away by God. Then there's 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Peter there is talking about God's treatment of Noah's contemporaries. That generation of which Moses records in Genesis 6, verse 5, every intention of the thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually. And Peter says, as a consequence, God did not spare those people. And what that means, of course, is elaborated, isn't it, in Genesis 6, verse 7. The Lord said, I will blot out man from the face of the earth. So in 2 Peter 2, verse 5, to be not spared by God is to be blotted out from the face of the earth. And then there's 2 Peter 2, verse 4. There, Peter is talking about God's treatment of those angels, who again, despite all their privileges, despite being these eminent, entrusted servants of God, yet rebelled against God. And Peter says, as a consequence, God did not spare them. And what that means is elaborated there in that very same verse where he puts it very simply. God cast them into hell. And so you see what I'm saying then. When in the New Testament God doesn't spare, he really doesn't spare. He doesn't spare in the most final and absolute sense, and presumably then that's the case here when we come to Romans 8, verse 32. And when Paul says that God didn't spare Jesus, it's saying that God inflicted upon Jesus his very worst. He summoned all his mighty power and did his very worst to Jesus. He unleashed a torrent of unrestrained, undiluted vengeance on Jesus. In the language of those other texts, he threw Jesus onto his cosmic garbage heap. He blotted Jesus out of the face of the earth. He cast Jesus into hell. That's what Paul is saying here in Romans 8:32. That, extraordinarily, is the content involved in this Good Friday event. But then, surprising element number three, the benefit derived. The benefit derived. Over the past few months, we've seen both the actor Bill Roach and the politician Nigel Evans, having been cleared of serious charges against them, standing in front of the press and using the phrase, there are no winners in this situation. There are no winners. And surely, as God doesn't spare Jesus on this day, surely there can be no winners. Surely in an event that is so solemn and so dreadful, surely there can be no winners. But Paul says, no, there are winners here. Those wonderful three little words, for us all. And of course, he's not here addressing the world generally. He's addressing a Christian church in Rome. And he's saying that we are the winners. This benefited us. We gained from this. This Good Friday event, this cross of Calvary, it was a divine gift directed at us. And we need to ask the question this morning, how on earth do we make sense of that? Over the past few days, we've had these bombs going off in the capital of Nigeria. And we've had a ferry capsizing and sinking off South Korea. At the minute, there's a man appearing in court, charged with the bombing of that northern Irish town of Omagh back in 1998. It's 25 years since Hillsborough. It's 100 years since the First World War. And while I would not for one moment want to belittle any of those notorious instances of suffering, we need to be clear that what Jesus suffered here was worse. It was worse than all those instances of suffering put together. The news reporters in Abuja and back in Omagh in 1998 might have used the very language of hell, trying to describe the scene of carnage. It's like hell on earth, they might say. But we've said this morning what happened here at Calvary was literally hell on earth. It was God, in the language of 2 Peter 2:4, casting Jesus, like those angels, into hell. And yet, when it comes to these other instances of suffering, we don't rejoice over them. We don't talk about them as a gift. We lament, we weep, we shudder, we recoil with horror as we listen to these stories unfolding on our radios. So how is it then that when we come to the most notorious instance of suffering of all, when it comes to Calvary, we can say it was a gift, it was for us all, and we can refer to this as Good Friday, and we can sing, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." How is it that we can talk about benefit being derived from what happened at Golgotha? Well, of course, we're diving here into the middle of Paul's epistle to the Romans. Paul's already explained all this earlier on in the letter. You know it yourselves how from chapter 1 verse 18 to chapter 3 verse 20, Paul has described how all of us as human beings are liable to God's wrath. We all deserve to be not spared by God. We all deserve him to do his very worst to us. And if nothing changes, then he will do his very worst to us for all eternity. But after those terribly bleak chapters, you then come to chapter 3, verse 25, where Paul uses that long word that doesn't make it into some of our modern English translations, that God set forth Jesus as a propitiation. What's a propitiation? A propitiation is something that removes wrath, that appeases, that pacifies, that mollifies, that exhausts and absorbs and redirects wrath that would otherwise have been endured. And Paul is saying that was what Jesus was doing at the cross. He was our propitiation. He was taking God's wrath in our place as a substitute. And that's how then Paul can say here in chapter 8, verse 32, it was for us all. There was benefit derived from it. There are winners from Calvary. There are no winners from Abuja, from South Korea, from Hillsborough, from these other events. There are winners from Calvary. And we are the winners because Jesus was taking our place. He was the propitiation, enduring God's wrath for us. And it is wonderful, isn't it, for us all as believers. John Murray puts it like this, commenting on that phrase. He says, "The Father contemplated all on behalf of whom he delivered up the Son in the distinctiveness of the sin, misery, liability, and need of each." He contemplated us all in the distinctiveness of our own sin and our own liability to wrath as he handed over Jesus at Calvary. In other words, whatever your sins have been, God was handing over Jesus as a propitiation for those sins. Whatever your particular track record, however murky your particular life of sin has been, if you're a believer this morning, God was handing over Jesus as the answer to that. It was for us all. It's why none of us then needs to be plagued this morning by a guilty conscience. None of us does. If we're believers in Jesus Christ, the wrath has been done away with. It's gone forever and ever because Jesus was our propitiation. And I'm saying this morning, that's the truth of the cross. There are certain things that you can say about the cross from just a quick glance at it. But Paul is saying the story is more complex. Notice the person responsible. Notice the content involved. Notice the benefit derived. The truth of the cross. Secondly, and we'll be more brief as we continue, the trauma of the cross. The trauma of the cross. Because I've then been talking about Jesus being handed over, being given up here in Romans 8:32. But actually, Paul doesn't mention the name Jesus, does he? He uses a different term. He says God didn't spare his own son. Who was this Jesus who was handed over? It was God's own son. Now, you know what it's like when you watch a film like Finding Nemo. I'm sure some of you must have watched Finding Nemo. And you enjoy the film and you get kind of emotionally drawn into this father-son relationship that's at the heart of the film. And then the film ends and you're just kind of climbing into bed, resolving that you're never going to buy a tropical fish from Peter Barrett's Garden Centre. You're never going to support an industry that separates fathers and sons like that. You're not even sure whether you should patronise the local chippy anymore. When it suddenly strikes you that, hang on a minute, these are fish that we're talking about. And fish don't relate to each other in the way that human beings relate to each other. And the filmmakers then have taken this deep, rich, profound relationship between a human parent and child and have projected that onto these primitive underwater creatures. And from a cinematic perspective, it may be powerful, but in actual fact, it's nonsense. And surely it's the same here when we come to Romans 8:32. But yes, kind of for a moment, it's very moving, isn't it? This language of God not sparing his own son. For a moment, it kind of takes your breath away, and for a moment, you're drawn into this story. But then it suddenly strikes you. Hang on a minute. We're talking here about God, and God knows nothing of the kind of relationships that we know. And all Paul is doing here is taking this rich, deep, profound relationship between a human parent and child, and he's projecting it onto this unfeeling cosmic intelligence that is God. And yes, from a literary perspective, it may be very powerful, but in actual fact, it's nonsense. We might be tempted to think like that, and if we are, we need to stop ourselves and say no, no, no. You see, the father-son relationship, or the parent-child relationship, full stop, it is not a human patent. It didn't originate with us. It didn't come into existence the day that Adam and Eve had their firstborn son, Cain. No, the parent-child relationship, it goes back way, way further than that. It goes back into eternity, and it goes back into the very being of God. The original father-son relationship is the one between God the Father and God the Son, and our parent-child relationships are just a pale little model of that original one. In other words, We shouldn't read Romans 8:32 picturing in our heads the relationship between a human father and son, picturing a human father not sparing his son, and then think to ourselves, oh no, it's all right, it's not as traumatic as that, because this is just divine persons we're talking about here. No, it should be the other way around. We should read Romans 8:32, picturing perhaps a human father not sparing his son. And we should then think, hang on a minute, this is far more traumatic than that. This is infinitely more traumatic than that. Because this isn't the model. This is the real thing. This is the ultimate father-son relationship we're dealing with here. This is the true father, not sparing the true son. And in actual fact, I think Paul, as he writes this, does want us to picture perhaps two particular human father-son relationships. Because, again, this word spare is used twice in the Greek Old Testament relating to human father-son relationships. So one is the Abraham-Isaac relationship that was touched on in the Bible study on Wednesday evening. And in Genesis 22, verses 12 and 16, Abraham is commended for not sparing his son. Now, of course, he didn't have to go through with the complete execution, did he? But he had shown he was prepared to do so, and so he's commended for not sparing his son. And it is a traumatic read, isn't it, Genesis 22? And as a reader, you feel kind of torn. Yes, really, basically, you want Abraham to go through with this. Because it will be such a wonderful demonstration of his non-idolatrous love for God. That he does really love God more than anything else. And so you're rooting for him and you're wanting him to go through with it. But then there's something in you at the same time that is kind of saying, Abraham, just do a Jonah, just run away. Just don't go through with it. Spare this son, your only son. You've waited for him for so many years. It's such a waste now to have to give him up. And you are kind of torn as a reader. There's something so traumatic about it. The other instance then in the Old Testament is 2 Samuel 18, verse 5, and where David sends off Joab and the soldiers to fight against Absalom and his soldiers. And his kind of parting comment to the army is, look, spare Absalom. If you find Absalom, please spare him. And again, you can relate to it as a reader, can't you? And again, you feel kind of torn on the one hand. And basically you feel, well, that's ridiculous, David. Absalom must be killed. For the sake of the whole kingdom of Israel, the messianic kingdom, the messianic line, for the sake of the salvation of the world, Absalom must be removed. And you want Absalom to be removed. You want that order to be ignored. But there's something in you at the same time that feels for David and wants almost Absalom to be spared and to be returned to his father. And Paul then wants us to picture, I think, those two stories. But rather than seeing this as less traumatic, he wants us to understand this is more traumatic. And that as we read the passion narratives, we should feel torn even. Yes, basically, we want God to go through with the sacrifice of his son. Of course we do. Our salvation, the redemption of the cosmos depends upon it. Of course we want him to go through with it, but isn't there something in us that even as we read the passion narratives is saying, don't do it, Father. Don't put yourself through that. Don't put him through that. Don't give up your beloved son in this terrible way. Whatever you think of him as a musician, whatever you think of him as a man. You couldn't help feeling for Bob Geldof recently in the loss of his daughter. And you probably heard his comments. Peaches has died. We are beyond pain. She was the wildest, funniest, cleverest, wittiest, and the most bonkers of all of us. Writing was, destroys me afresh. What a beautiful child. How is this possible that we will not see her again? How is that bearable? We loved her and will cherish her forever. And I'm saying, Abraham, David, Bob Geldof, all of these are little models, little imitations of the real father, who didn't spare his son. This is traumatic. The aching sense of loss that must have consumed the Heavenly Father there at Golgotha as he himself put his son through all of this must have been beyond pain. The trauma of the cross. So the truth of the cross, the trauma of the cross, thirdly and finally, the testimony of the cross. The testimony of the cross. So we need to ask then, why is Paul mentioning this here in Romans 8:32? We've said already that he has made the argument for propitiation earlier in the epistle. He's taught there, he's explained there fully why God gave up Jesus. He's covered all that ground. Why is he returning to it here in chapter 8, verse 32? Well, here in chapter 8, and the second half of chapter 8 particularly, as many of you will know, Paul is talking about the believer's future glory. That's the heading we have in our ESV Bibles over verse 18. He's talking about the believer's future resurrection glory, and in particular, he's impressing upon us the certainty of this future glory. It's not a vague wish. It's a definite prospect. That's what he's saying in the last part of Romans 8. And he argues then the certainty of our future glory in several different ways. He argues it from the fact that we already possess the first fruits of it. That's in verse 23, where he says that we have already the first fruits of the Spirit. It's the Spirit who will raise us and glorify us on the last day, and already the Spirit is active within our lives now. So we already have the deposit, the down payment, the first installment of that future glory, in a sense. And again, he argues it from predestination, verses 29 and 30. Those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. And I don't think he's talking there about being conformed to the image of God's Son ethically, in our characters. That's true, of course. And you get that in other New Testament passages. Here he's talking about physically. We have been predestined to be ultimately like Jesus in our very bodies, resurrected like his. And it's predestined, so it can't go wrong. It can't be derailed. God has predestined that this is going to happen. It's certain. Then again, he argues it from our invulnerability to accusation. Verses 33 and 34, this surely is the greatest threat, we might think, to us one day being glorified. That sometime between now and then, Satan will come along with some damning accusation. He's got plenty of material for it, after all. And that will just scupper the whole thing. And Paul says, no, we're invulnerable to accusations because Christ has died. And he's even now interceding on the basis of his death. We are utterly untouchable to any of Satan's charges. Then again, he argues it on the basis of the power of Christ's love. That, I think, is the point in verses 35 to 37, that Christ's love isn't like our love. Our love can be very intense, but it has no power. We can desire with all our hearts the safety of our loved ones, but our love can't actually ensure the safety of our loved ones. Our love is impotent. It's powerless. Christ's love is powerful. Nothing can separate us from it. So in all these different ways then, he argues the certainty of our future glory. And here in verse 32, he's giving another argument. And his argument here is this. He's arguing on the basis of God's past investment in our salvation. God has invested so much already that there's no way he's not going to complete the thing and glorify us on the last day. That's the logic here. Perhaps I could illustrate it. In the summer, as you know, we tend to go to the very far north of Scotland for our holiday, and we stay in a caravan up there. Now imagine that this summer then we arrive there, and I get out the car and go and speak to the lady who runs the site and say we're here, and she says, okay, you're in that caravan over there, and directs me to it. And then she just happens to comment, oh, and by the way, there was a slight problem with your booking and you still owe £2.50. And imagine then at that point that I just went mad, and I went and got back in the car and said to Hannah, look, we're not staying here. These are money-grabbing people. We're heading back home straight away. Well, I think Hannah would probably say to me in the nicest possible way, don't be an idiot. We've already paid money for this that we're not going to get back, and we've spent hours trying to squeeze all our stuff into the car, and then we've spent the best part of 2 days driving up here with the children asking every 5 minutes, are we there yet? And so we're not going to balk at paying another £2.50 in order to be able to stay in the caravan. And that's the logic here, you see, that Paul is getting at. He's saying, look, God has already done so much for our salvation. He's already not spared his own son. He's already been through the anguish of Good Friday. In his moving little book, A Lament for a Son, Nicholas Walterstorff, a Christian academic in America who lost his son in a mountaineering accident, he says in the introduction, he says that whenever someone says to me, who are you? Tell me about yourself. I say to them, not immediately but shortly, I say, I am one who lost a son. I am one who lost a son. And God is one who lost a son. That is who he is. And Paul is saying, if he's been through that, if he's been through Golgotha, for you, he's not going to balk at glorifying you on the last day. That's £2.50 by comparison. That's nothing. He's done this. He's done the massive part, the agonizing part, the nightmarish part. He will definitely do the rest. You've no need to worry. You've no need to fear. A God who has not spared his own son for you will do everything. This isn't a wealth and prosperity text, graciously give us all things. It's talking about future glory, the all things that's in view throughout Romans 8. And he will. He won't keep anything back for you, from you, if he hasn't kept back from you his son on the day when, if ever he would have spared him, he would have spared him. May God help us to be thus assured. Amen.